Jodcast, Consuming an Earth-like Planet, with Melanie Gendre, Stuart Harper, Melis Irfan, Tim O'Brien, Kat Maguire, and Christina Smith. The Jodcast, May 2012, Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. Joining me in the studio today is Melis Irfan and Christina Smith. Hi, guys.
Hi.
In the show this time, we talk to Nick Germanic about astrophotography, Professor Alan Fitzsimmons about the Near Earth Object Shield Project, Dr. Thomas Target about massive black holes, and your astronomical questions are answered in Ask an Astronomer. But first, before all of that, Stuart talks to Fotini Laiku about evolved stars in this month's Jodbite.
In this Jodbite, I have been joined by Fotini Laiku, who has recently been a co-author in a paper released in the 12th of April edition of Nature. The paper is about the measurements of dust grains around AGB stars and their effects on stellar winds. So, to begin with, what is an AGB star?
Well, an AGB star is a star much older than our Sun, usually a Sun-type star of 1 to 8 solar masses, let's say, and it's currently dying, so which is why we say we have mass loss, basically. So it loses up to 80% of its original mass.
And so what does dust grains have to do with the mass loss, the ejection from these AGB stars?
Well, yes, but the general idea so far is that the mass loss is initiated by radiative pressure. So you have light transferring momentum, pushing the dust out either by absorption or by scattering. And as a consequence, the dust will later on push the gas out, the molecular and atomic, the molecular layers of the star out by collisions. So basically it helps to drive a wind that guides all the material out.
So is this a sort of a much larger version of the stellar wind we'd get from the Sun, for example?
Yes, well, I'm not sure what is the exact amount from the Sun, but for the AGB stars, it can be 10 to the minus 6 up to 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year, which is pretty huge, basically.
That's quite a lot of material, yeah, definitely. So the paper in Nature is actually about the detection of these dust grains around the stars. So how exactly did you do that? What did you do to detect the dust grains?
Well, what we wanted to do, and this is a project led by Barnaby Norris in the University of Sydney, was to look at the dust near the surface of the star. So we had to employ a technique called interferometry, where basically you're allowed to look at very small stars. Well, it gives you better resolution, and you're allowed to look at the near the surface of the stars. And to look at the dust as well, the dust shells around the stars, we have to use polarimetry. Because, you know, light, which is scattered, it's polarized, so you need this technique. And this has been done in the near infrared because these cool giants, the three giants we looked at were W. Haia, R. Doradus, and R. Leo, are large oxygen-rich AGB stars. Oxygen-rich meaning that they have a larger abundance of oxygen compared to carbon, which is the other most abundant molecule in those stars. And, well, trying to figure out the size and the composition of the dust grains in those shells.
And how large exactly are the dust particles that, or dust grains that are driving the gas out in the stellar winds?
Well, in this particular case, from the modeling that we have done, we found that the dust grains, which are in this case mainly composed of silicates, are about 600 nanometers in diameter, which are larger than the light that basically pushes them forward. And we also see that those silicate grains are iron-free. So a silicate grain will basically have magnesium, iron, silicon and oxygen. Now, the grains that we used in the modeling do not have any iron at all. And that is because if you have iron in a grain near the stellar surface, the grain will melt as it absorbs light. Whereas if you if you don't have any iron, so iron-free silicates, the grain will mostly scatter the light. So in all cases for the three stars that we have, basically, we found that the grains are about 2 stellar radii away from the surface, which is pretty close. Where if it was an iron-rich grain, it would be further out, so 5 to perhaps 10 stellar radii away. It wouldn't be able to survive near the stellar surface.
Yeah, so these dust grains technically are quite far out, though, in a way.
Yes, they are far out.
Yeah, they're nowhere near. They're sort of in the very external atmospheres of the stars in general.
Yes, there are, and they, you know, they extend further out. Of course, the atmosphere, as it's the layer extends further out from the actual surface of the star.
Okay. Well, as a final question, so how much of the material in the interstellar medium is generated by the stellar winds, as opposed to, say, supernovas?
Well, there's an argument in general scientific community about that, whether supernovae are the main contributors to the mass in the interstellar medium, or is it the AGB stars? But I would say that AGB stars are the main contributors and reach the ISM with heavier material, and by heavier I mean dust mainly, which can then, you know, be recycled by younger stars and lead up to what we have now as a solar system.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And goodbye.
Thanks for that, Stuart. Next up, Stuart talks to Nick Germanic about astrophotography.
Hello, this is Stuart Harper, and I'm here at the National Astronomy Meeting, and I've been joined with Nick Germanic. So do you want to tell me about what you do?
Well, I lead a double life, actually. Mm-hmm. I have a full-time day job as a train driver on the London Underground, and I have a very interesting hobby, which is amateur astronomy, which is combined with photography. So I'm an astrophotographer. That's been something that's I've been interested in for over 20 years now, and I've been very lucky enough to have been involved with the new technology involved with astrophotography right from the very early days. And we've also been very lucky in the fact that we've been able to travel to some very nice locations abroad, Hawaii, for example, Mauna Kea Observatory, and La Palma in the Canary Islands, to do astrophotography out there as an amateur astronomer. So I've been invited to go out there to use the dark sky facilities, not the actual telescopes themselves. Mm-hmm. So we've been out there 15 or 16 times now to very dark sky sites. But these days, the majority of work that I actually do is from a light-polluted location in Essex. But with the quality of instrumentation that's now available to amateurs, it's possible to get really good results. And, you know, hopefully that will come across in the talk that I'm about to give this afternoon. Mm-hmm. So we'll be comparing modern amateur images with professional images of a couple of decades ago.
What do you use at home then? What is it you've got down in Essex?
Well, it's a very well-equipped observatory, because it's something I've been building towards for the last 20 years. I mean, we've seen this incredible rise in the quality of the instrumentation, not only in terms of cameras, but in terms of telescopes and mounts. These are the three things you need to do astronomy or astrophotography successfully. A camera, and it can be either a CCD camera, which is my camera of choice, a DSLR camera, it's a cheap entry-level system for people starting out and will deliver good results. A telescope of some description. Modern apochromatic refractors are very, very well priced now, mm-hmm. and of exceedingly good quality compared to 10 years ago. And then, of course, the mounting system itself, the equatorial mount, which tracks these things in the sky. The sky's moving the whole time. We need to have equipment that will track that. And I've gone for the very best I can afford in that sense, which is a Paramount ME. This is one of the sort of top-level amateur level mounts, and this is great because it's been completely and utterly reliable from day one. It'll point the telescope to where I want it to go, it'll track the telescope with incredible precision, mm-hmm. it'll track the telescope across the sky with incredible precision. So the heart of my system is a Paramount ME equatorial head. Mm-hmm. I'm using a 10-inch Ritchie Crescian telescope for the majority of images. I've also got a small refractor for wide field work, and I use QSI CCD cameras. I've got two of those, One is a average size chip, medium size chip, but with very high efficiency, and the other is a larger chip but with lower efficiency. So it's a case of mixing and choosing the camera to suit the target.
What makes the difference between these CCD cameras and a normal camera, like the SLR camera?
Well, there are significant differences. I mean, if you compare the detector technology, they have a common heritage. They share a common heritage, but where they divide, a DSLR is a mass-produced sensor, mm-hmm. which has a matrix of colour filters that takes colour pictures because that's what people want to do, quite rightly. Mm-hmm. And if you go into the other branch, the CCD camera, they're generally monochrome cameras. So they only take images of shades of grey, black and white, and to produce colour pictures we need to use colour filters, and that can either be red, green and blue filters or narrow band filters such as hydrogen alpha, oxygen 3 and sulphur 2, for example. But a significant difference is that not only do we have the flexibility by using coloured filters with monochrome cameras, but we also have the cameras cooled. So what happens is electronic detectors in DSLRs and CCDs generate a certain amount of noise, for example, unwanted signal during the course of a 5 or 10 minute exposure. So what we have to do, we cool the CCD camera, because for every 8 degrees reduction in operating temperature for the sensor in the camera, mm-hmm. that halves the electronic noise. So yeah. when I'm working from home, in the winter time, I can run my CCD camera at a temperature of below minus 30. That really does withhold this electronic noise from building up. Yeah. Now, DSLR doesn't have that luxury. So what it means is that you're limited, particularly working in a warm location like the UK in the summer,
yeah.
you'll find that the electronic noise will become quite apparent within 2 or 3 minutes of exposures, whereas my own cameras can go on for 40-minute exposures or something like that without too much problem from this dark current that afflicts the exposures. But don't forget, DSLRs, you can buy them for incredibly good prices now. The sensors are large, they're very high quality sensors, and the cameras are really well priced, and they're very suitable for astronomy, but you're limited by the kind of targets you can go for. They're very susceptible to light pollution. They're not so user friendly, for example, with narrowband filters, whereas with a dedicated monochrome camera, they're perfect recording instruments. They're really sort of great.
You've talked a little bit about how you could do the dark frames to remove mm-hmm. noise, but I mean, what other sort of software processes can you do? I mean, what do you do when you process your images?
Well, I mean, the start of any good image is the calibration frames that I've talked about, the dark frames, the flat frames mm-hmm. and the bias. I mean, that is CCD nuts and bolts. That has to be done, and then you just move on from that point once you've got that data. But then you can use software to open your black and white image, for example, that's been taken through colour filters. The first thing you would do would be to combine those into a colour image. And there's all sorts of software that can do that, but my favourite of all of that is Adobe Photoshop, which is a desktop editing package for everyday photography and design and graphics, this kind of stuff. But it's tailor-made for astronomy as well. So you can combine your colour images using one of several techniques in Photoshop. But what's even better than that is that you can use Photoshop's advanced filters, its filtering algorithms, to start to extract the detail that is contained within your images but maybe hidden by, for example, the poor seeing, the poor quality of the atmosphere. And it's great fun to do. It allows you to put a personal stamp on an image. And one thing I always say at the talks that I do is that if there was 50 people in the audience and they were all CCD images, I could say to them, give them all a copy of the same image, like a galaxy or something like that, tell them to go away and then come back a week later and show me how they'd processed it, and you could almost guarantee that every one of those would be slightly different in a sense. Mm-hmm. I like to keep the sky background a little bit brighter than jet black because it shows you all the edge contours of galaxies and nebulae. Some people like the sky to be absolutely jet black. The colour combination is a very subjective thing. If we're imaging galaxies, we try to keep it objective rather than subjective, but once we go into narrowband imaging with hydrogen alpha filters and others, you're creating what's to all intents and purposes a false colour image. So you can stamp your own personality on the images in that sense. You can use colour palettes that you like and other people haven't used and this kind of stuff. So it's quite a personal thing, but the software's out there. There's free software. There's a free equivalent of Photoshop called GIMP, which is, I think it was originally written for Linux, but you know, it's filtered into the sort of Windows operating system, and you can download that. It's very, very heavily featured. And there's all sorts of intermediate programs that you can use for different, you know, generally plugins, for example, for Photoshop that can deal with light pollution in your images and, you know, color registration. There's some, you know, people are writing this software all day long, and there's a good choice of that sort of stuff.
So how much are these sort of, as an entry level sort of CCD, if someone did want to sort of move from the SLR to that level of
amateur? They vary in cost. I mean, there's a couple of companies in the UK that produce high quality cameras for very reasonable prices. So whenever I get asked that question, which I do get asked a lot after the talks that I do, people are quite keen to start out. One thing I'd normally say to people is you're better off perhaps starting with a DSLR. Yeah. Put that on your telescope and your mounting system and get used to things like auto guiding and focusing and stuff like that, because a lot of people have already got a DSLR camera for their day-to-day sort of family use, this kind of stuff. So we'd always recommend starting with that, and if you're happy with the results and you want to go a step further, you can buy what we can call entry-level cameras for probably about £500, I think, at the first entry-level camera. And then they're good quality cameras. You can do very good work with these. They do colour cameras as well as monochrome, but as I said earlier, I would recommend monochrome cameras, although that of course means investing in a filter set and a filter wheel of some sort, preferably motorised, just to streamline the whole process. So then, once you've done that, if you're happy with the results and you then wish to improve, then you can start basically with CCD cameras. The more you pay, the better you tend to get. So you'll find you're going up towards larger chips, larger sensors within the cameras, higher efficiency sensors, there may be better cooling, for example, all this kind of stuff. But there's definitely a learning curve there, and you may be limited by budgetary constraints. I mean, you can really get a full astrophotography rig for probably about altogether for about £1,400. So that's a mounting system, telescope, a camera, and an auto-guiding camera, which takes care of all of the fine tracking.
Okay, so it's quite an investment, but...
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's doable.
What we find is that very few people actually go in at that level. They start simple and then just work upwards, and if they like the hobby, because some people get into the hobby and don't enjoy it. You know, the endless cloudy nights, the moonlight, all this kind of stuff, it does stop you from flowing along in the hobby, certainly. But what you find is that people who enjoy the hobby will then look to upgrade, and that'll be the telescope mount, even the telescope itself, and certainly the camera. And then you can pay anything up to the mid-range cameras like I use are typically £3,000 to £4,000 each, something like that. So expensive, a serious outlay, definitely. But you get what you pay for in that field, certainly. So the results do show you do see a big improvement in performance once you start going up to these high-end cameras.
Okay, well, moving on to sort of a bit more about the sort of the history of what you've done, because you said you worked out in La Palma, and I heard that you started helping out with things like the William Herschel telescope. So how did that come about?
That was really exciting. What happened was we went out to La Palma initially to find a place to observe without light pollution. So I went out there as an amateur astronomer and was very lucky to meet a person who's become a very good friend, who was actually an instrumentation engineer on the three UK scopes. And he opened a huge amount of doors for us. He got us permission to work at the observatory. And because we've been doing it every year, they know that we're fairly serious about what we do. We understand the sort of protocols involved with working from these locations. You know, you can't go around with car lights on or, you know, torches or anything. You have to adhere very carefully to the professional standards. But we do that because we're serious about what we do. And we built up a very good working reputation with a lot of the regular staff there. And I'd do a lot of public relations work for them. I'd shoot the telescopes in the daytime, shoot the telescopes at night, come back and give talks in the UK and spread the word really about the great work that's being done by UK and other, it's a multinational site on La Palma, other astronomers that are there. So then they understood that I was very keen on the image processing side of CCD imaging. So it's a 50-50 thing. The first 50% is actually acquiring the data, and then the second 50% is going into your bedroom or something with a computer and then just actually, you know, working with image processing techniques to actually extract the very maximum detail from your images.
Yeah.
And then after that, they understood that I was very keen on image processing. I've worked with other projects in the UK, and they said, we've got these what we call public relations images. They were shot with cameras for trial purposes to see how the cameras are performing. They had a large archive of images that people had taken in the past and never bothered going back to. So they said, would you be interested in applying sort of the image processing to our images? So I said, well, yes. And without a shadow of a doubt, the quality of the images they're getting out there were absolutely first rate. You know, the sky conditions are fantastic, the instrumentation's great, it's a world-class site. So it was easy. You know, to process their images was simple because you're not dealing with light pollution and other problems. You're just dealing with very high quality data. So that took up a couple of years working with different data from different telescopes, with the three use case scopes out there. And it's actually gone into other departments as well. These astronomers have come into La Palma, you know, done an imaging run and then disappeared, and then sort of got back to me and said, well, I've got my data. Would you have a look at that for me? And yeah, well, of course I will. And it's got a bit quiet at the moment, but it sort of tends to go in fits and bursts. So it's just, the point I'm trying to put across here is it's easier to process their data than it is to process my own, because I'm dealing with the problems with light pollution and poor seeing and all this kind of stuff. So it's a pleasure to do that for them, and they've reciprocated by allowing us to go out there. They give us facilities to work in with their own equipment every year, in a really fantastic site. So it's a great working relationship, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty lucky to get involved with that. That sounds pretty amazing. Yeah, so thank you very much for talking
to me.
And I hope your talk goes really well.
Thanks.
Later on.
I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully show you what we've been talking about.
Yeah,
here.
I'll actually get to see the images.
Yeah,
that'd be exciting
to get through. So yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks for that, Stuart. And as we strive to be the BBC, there are, of course, other products available other than those mentioned by Nick. Now we have Christina talking to Professor Alan Fitzsimmons about the NeoShield project.
Joining me today is Professor Alan Fitzsimmons of Queen University Belfast. Hello, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome.
And you've just given a talk on the NeoShield, a global approach to new impact threat mitigation. Can you sort of explain what NeoShield is?
Okay, well, let's break it down into sections there. NEO stands for NEO, or Near Earth Object. Now, we've known for decades that the Earth is like any other body in a solar system. It's still accreting bits of stuff left over from its formation 4.5 billion years ago. Small bits of rock that we would call asteroids, much smaller than a planet, and also small bits of ice that we call comets. And when I say small, we're actually looking at anything up to maybe 10 kilometres across, but it's much smaller than a planet. Now, we observe these, and they're very interesting from a scientific point of view, because as they're in the same region of the solar system as our planet, it gives us a close-up view of some of these things left over from the birth of our solar system. But of course, occasionally, if they do hit us, then they can have quite dramatic effects. And in the past, when they've hit us, we haven't really worried about it. In fact, we're now pretty certain that 65 million years ago, a very large asteroid or comet hit the Earth, and that precipitated the extinction of the dinosaurs, giving rise to the age of mammals and eventually us. But saying that, we don't want that to happen again.
Yeah.
So the NeoShield project is to assist us in figuring out what to do if we ever find an asteroid or a comet that is likely to hit us in the next century.
Okay, so it's ways of stopping any potential threat against the Earth, like from asteroids.
That's right. I mean, actually, although to be honest, we always have to be clear about this. The Earth won't notice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. As a planet, it's a big. We've identified over 200 craters left from the impacts of asteroids and comets on the surface of the Earth so far. And in fact, we'd have a lot more if it wasn't for the erosion caused by the Earth's weather and atmosphere and plate tectonics. Now, the thing is that these things don't happen that often, let's be honest about it. We don't continuously walk around and worry about what's going to fall on us from above. But we know it's happened in the past, and we know it's going to happen again in the future. It's a natural process. From surveys of the solar system and looking particularly for near-Earth asteroids and comets, we know that something about the size of a kilometre across hits us perhaps once every 800,000 years to once every million years. As you go down to smaller sizes, there's more of them, and so they hit us more frequently. Something perhaps 100 metres across hits us once every few 10,000 years, and something perhaps 30 metres across or 40 metres across may hit us once every few hundred years. Now, things that small will not really even affect our civilization, but their energy that they released when they hit us would be enough to wipe out, say, a city or certainly a small region of land. And so we'd like to avoid that happening, yes, if at all possible.
So have you got, are there ideas as to how you could possibly stop them from happening?
Absolutely. Now, one thing is, it's not going to be like Hollywood and Bruce Willis with all the TV or movies that you can see in that waiting for the last moment to do anything. We've actually got on paper a number of technologies that we could use, all of which involve generally nudging the asteroid so that it follows a slightly different orbit, and it, by doing so, it, instead of hitting the Earth, flies safely past. Now, those three mechanisms are in turn what we call a kinetic impactor, where we have a very fast moving spacecraft that literally just runs into the near Earth object,
pushing it away.
Absolutely, it hits it, it gets vaporized, and the conservation of momentum means that the much larger asteroid moves it slightly itself, and that puts it onto a different orbit and misses us. Another idea is the gravity tractor, where again we take a large spacecraft, but here we rendezvous with the object and we just hover above it. And we know that the laws of gravity state that even though the asteroid is pulling on the spacecraft pulls on the asteroid. And by maintaining its position over perhaps a decade or so, we'd slowly, gently move that asteroid onto a slightly different orbit. Once again, it would miss us.
How far away would you have to be from the asteroid? How far away would the spacecraft have to hover?
Well, that's a problem. It would have to probably hover only 2 or 3 radii from the object. And these asteroids, even the smallest ones, are quite irregular. And they're also spinning. And so one thing that we'll be investigating in this project is that if we went for this gravity tractor, how well could we maintain station to make sure we kept pulling the asteroid in the same direction, and could we in fact do it for 10 years or more?
Is that the length of time it would in reality take?
Probably so. Even with a kinetic impactor, we would have to hit it several years before its projected impact with the Earth, to make sure that by the time it got to the Earth's vicinity, the nudge we gave it at that point had been enough to move it slightly and make sure that it missed the Earth.
Okay. Are there any other possible mechanisms that you could employ?
Well, the technique that nobody's really wanted to discuss in the past has been the nuclear option. Now, that's not vaporizing the object, but what you do is you take a high-yield nuclear weapon and you explode it above the surface of the asteroid.
Okay.
And what that does, that it vaporizes the surface of the asteroid facing the nuclear explosion, and again that material blasts off in one direction, so the asteroid moves slowly in the other direction. Again, we're using the conservation of momentum to move that object, just like the kinetic impactor. Now, this is a very efficient way to do this, because of course even a small nuclear weapon releases a huge amount of energy. Of course, however, we have some incredible political and security implications and ethical implications as well that we need to address. And so, although we will be looking at this option for deflecting an asteroid, we'll be involving, of course, the United Nations and various other space agencies and government level agencies, just to make sure that we play on an even keel with everyone. We are not suggesting that this is something we should do, but it would be silly not to investigate that possibility of using that technique.
So are there different time frames that are available? Because obviously you said the gravity tractor had to be used for, say, 10 years. Sort of, does each different method have its own merits to time frame? Or
definitely. If we've got a few years warning or more, and the object is relatively small, certainly less than a kilometre across, then a kinetic impactor can work. Okay. If we've got more than a decade, we could also think of a gravity tractor. But if we've only got a few years warning, say less than five, or the object is fairly large, a kilometre or larger, then the only option we have at the moment is a nuclear device. Now, saying that, those objects do hit very rarely, and it's likely that over the next 20 years we won't find an object like that. But we can never be sure. The only asteroid we've ever detected that was definitely on an impact trajectory was a small asteroid. Sure, it was only 4 meters across, and so we knew that it would burn up in the Earth's atmosphere, but that was only detected 19 hours before impact. So with a larger object, we'd see it much further out and a longer time before impact, but we have to be aware of all the implications and all possibilities.
So are there projects in place to detect these near-Earth objects that could potentially be a hazard? Are there different telescopes?
Absolutely. There are several surveys that have been ongoing for the past decade or more to detect near-Earth objects and catalogue them and just check that they're not coming anywhere near us. And now we've almost got 9,000 near-Earth asteroids that we've detected. And in fact, the discovery rate has accelerated as we've brought online larger telescopes and more sensitive cameras. And so now we detect about 900 new objects every year.
Wow.
And so we really are accelerating. That's because simply there's a lot more out there. And even with 900 new objects being found every year, we've probably still only found 10% of the objects that, if they hit us, would make it through the Earth's atmosphere and cause some destruction at the Earth's surface.
So most of the ones that are discovered are very small and would just be vaporised in the atmosphere as they came in?
Well, there's a whole range. In fact, what we've done so far up to now is concentrate on the large ones, because anything a kilometre across or larger, the model suggests that that would cause global climate change in a matter of days. And in fact, it's the opposite of what we're worried about at the moment, global warming. It would cause global cooling because of all the debris put up into the stratosphere. And predictions state that a large proportion of humanity would actually perish due to the ensuing food shortages. Now, the good news there is that we've found most of those objects already. There's just a few left to sweep up, but we've found most of those objects, and none of them are coming anywhere near us in the next 100 years. But it's the small objects that we're now worrying about. The small objects are fainter, and so they're more difficult to see, they're more difficult to spot. And so you do need the largest or larger telescopes, and you need wide field cameras to survey as much of the sky as possible at the same time. So the largest facility we've got working at the moment is a facility that we're involved with at Queen's University. It's called the Pan-STARRS Telescope.
Okay.
You can think of it as the largest digital camera in the world.
Okay.
Now, I've got a camera on my phone that I think that's 8 megapixels, and you know, 5 megapixels, 8 megapixels is quite familiar with us. Well, this has a camera that's got 1,400 megapixels, or 1.4 gigapixels. And the Pan-STARRS 1 telescope is spending 3.5 years surveying the entire night sky visible from Hawaii. But at the same time, we're using it to survey for near-Earth asteroids and anything else out there that's orbiting our sun.
Okay, so it's doing continual surveys over the sky. Awesome. So the NEOShield project itself, it's a relatively new project. And so its main focus is to plan. Is there anything more you can say about that?
The thing is that we don't have the money to actually build a space mission. But the important thing is that that's not what we want to do. What we want to do is find out if we want to see and show that we can move an asteroid, which is something that nobody has done up to now, then we want to plan that out properly. So that's what NEOShield is doing. That's its primary focus, is to look at the different technologies, investigate them in quite some depth, and select one or maybe two that we could test with a relatively low-cost mission. Because if we were to launch such a mission in the future and show that we can move an asteroid, then we're pretty happy. We can sit back and let the surveys continue and wait until we do find an object that's on a threatening trajectory. However, if we launch such a mission, and with the best modelling and best engineering and best technology that we have to offer, we find that we can't move an asteroid with that, then we know we're in a problem. We've got to put our thinking caps on. So it's the purpose of Nearshield is to see whether or not we can plan a mission to see if we can move an asteroid. And that will take us about three and a half years. So in the summer of 2015, we should have a good idea of what we want to do next.
Okay. It's absolutely fantastic. But the concepts of the gravity tractor and everything are absolutely amazing. But yeah, thank you very much for stopping to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Christina. Next up, we have Melanie talking to Dr. Thomas Target about massive black holes.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm here today with Dr. Thomas Target from the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Enjoying the conference?
It's been great so far, actually.
So I saw from your poster that you're working on massive black hole in a very distant universe, and I thought that sounds really exciting, and so I chased you down to try to interview you, but can you tell me more about it?
Sure thing. Well, I'll start you off with a sentence that you'll find in many papers these days, and it's that every massive galaxy at its center contains a supermassive black hole. And this is actually true in our own galaxy. If you look in the center of our galaxy, it's about 25,000 light years away, we see there's a tremendous black hole, sort of 10 to the 8, 10 billion sort of solar mass black hole, i.e. weighing about that much more than our sun. And we know this because if you look at it, you can't see the black hole itself because it's black. But around it, you can see stars that are orbiting it, and because these stars are very massive themselves, but because the black hole is so massive, it accelerates the stars up to sort of 0.3 times the speed of light, which is incredibly fast for something that heavy. So we were able to use that just using Newton's equations to determine that this black hole must be incredibly massive. But if we look at other galaxies in the local region, we're actually able to determine that every other massive galaxy also has a central supermassive black hole at its core. And what was really interesting when we discovered this was that the mass of the black hole is related to the mass of the galaxy. So if you have a big galaxy, it's got a big black hole in the middle. If you've got a smaller galaxy, there's a smaller black hole in the middle. And this tells you something fundamental about the sort of coevolution of black holes and the galaxies that host them, because they would not have this very tightly correlated relationship unless there was some sort of mechanism that sort of regulated them as they were growing together. So because we always see a big black hole and a big galaxy, small black hole, we know that as the two grew up together, they were interacting. So it's sort of like a cosmic chicken and the egg. Which one came first? Did you have a big galaxy that makes a big black hole in the center, or did you have a bigger black hole that accreted a big galaxy around it? So what we do now is try and look further and further back in time to see if we can see a big galaxy with a small black hole, or vice versa, to see which one came first.
Have you found anything?
Yes. So the results from this poster were effectively saying that as we start to look further and further back in time, we notice that there's an offset between the two and that the relationship is actually changing. And we know this because we can measure the two at increasing redshift, but it's not that easy.
How far back are you looking?
The ones I'm talking about in my poster are about 12 billion years ago. So it's only about 1.6 billion years after the Big Bang, after everything started. But the problem is measuring the mass of the galaxy and the mass of the black hole at this high redshift is very difficult. As I said, in our own galaxy, we can see stars going around the black hole, and that tells us the mass of the black hole. But at high redshift, we have to use a slightly different technique. And what we can do is look at, as I said, we can't see the black hole, but we can see light that comes from around it in something called an accretion disk. So as matter falls in towards the black hole, it starts to spin up and form a disk and gets very, very, very hot and emits radiation. And that radiation travels out and hits other clouds of dust and gas that are surrounding it and creates these incredibly broad emission lines, which we can measure the width of. And the width of that line tells you how fast gas is going around the black hole. And just like watching a star go around the black hole, you can use Newton's equations to work out how fast the gas is going and hence how massive the black hole is.
What kind of data you take? Is it like optical data, radio data, UV?
Okay, so we use near-infrared imaging on sort of ground-based telescopes like the United Kingdom Infrared Telescope, UKIRT, or Gemini to observe the host galaxy. And then for the black hole, we'd use optical spectra to try and see how wide the line is and then get the black hole mass of the two.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so what we can do then is, once you have the black hole mass, you look at the galaxy, and the problem you have is that the light coming from the region around the black hole I told you about, which is wonderful for giving you the black hole mass, is a huge problem when trying to figure out the mass of the host galaxy, because it's sort of, you get so much more light from that central region than you do from the galaxy itself. So you have to spend a very long time taking your data and sort of treating it as lovingly as you can to effectively try and separate the light coming from the host galaxy as opposed to the light coming from the region around the black hole. And if you can do that, and we've been able to do this for two quasars at this very high redshift, which is very, very difficult. And thankfully, we've been able to do this, and that gave us an estimate of how much starlight there is coming from the host, and you can use that to work out how massive the host is. And it turns out, actually, that it looks like the black hole has actually finished growing before the galaxy. So it looks like in the case of chicken and egg for galaxy and black hole, it's actually the black hole that came first.
Okay, so your sample basically is so far only two because it's so difficult to get. What data do you use? Is it from data you took yourself? Is it from big surveys? How do you determine which one is a good candidate for this kind of study?
So quasars that are this bright, so you can see them at such high redshift, are very, very rare on the sky. So you typically won't find them in some of the big surveys that have been going on. And it would be great to do so, but unfortunately the surveys just aren't quite big enough yet. So we found these things in very shallow surveys that do exist, but we had to follow them up with data from the VLT, the Very Large Telescope, which is an 8-meter optical infrared telescope based in Chile. And for each source, we had to sit on it for about an entire night. We had to apply for this time, we got it, but because it's so much time just to one object, they wouldn't give us a huge sample. So they said, here you go, here's two objects, see what you can do with this, and if you do a good job, hopefully we'll be able to get more time. So fingers crossed for the next round of telescope allocations, where we might get to be able to do some more quasars and get an even better constraint on this relationship that we've been measuring.
Yeah, because it seemed that, well, two quasars, you get pretty good results, so they should give you a lot more time.
Yes, I completely agree.
I was wondering, since you're looking at, you want to look at something that's very far away, how about looking at the lens quasars? So those sources that are at high redshift but are lensed by another galaxy and would be magnified, would that be maybe good candidates for the kind of study you do?
Yeah, so lensing is a wonderful tool for trying to find things that are far away because it magnifies the light. But unfortunately, because it's so, so difficult to try and separate the light from the galaxy, from the light around the black hole, it's just too distorted. We'd have to have such a good understanding of what was happening with the lens to actually see this. So it does, unfortunately, require a big telescope for a long time to hopefully do this.
Yeah, but if it works with the next round and you get even more results, maybe you could try.
We could try. Obviously, the problem is if we get more data, you know, we'd love to have more data. It's just a question of getting it reduced and working on it. And as I said, if we can get up to 10 quasars, we're hopefully into a territory where we have a much better understanding of what's going on, because sort of more is good.
So I guess you just have to like hire more PhD students.
Yes, I definitely should have my own PhD student.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It was very nice to talk to you.
It was great chatting to you too. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And enjoy the conference.
Cheers.
Thanks for that, Melanie. Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other things we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends. So what story have you got for us this week, Christina?
I have a story about spaceplane engines. These spaceplane engines, it's known as the Skylon Spaceplane Project, and tests have started on the technology that would be used in these engines. The really cool thing about them is that these are part rocket engine and part jet engine. So they burn hydrogen and oxygen, but in the lower atmosphere, they're going to take in the oxygen from the atmosphere rather than having to store it like a jet engine. But at some point on its trajectory, it's going to flip to rocket mode and stop taking in the oxygen from the atmosphere and burn the oxygen that it has as a fuel supply, which is really, really cool. And it'll allow them to take off like a regular airliner and then flip to a rocket mode and go into space, which is so unbelievably cool.
It's like James Bond-style space travel.
Exactly. And the tests that are undergoing, obviously it has to undergo lots and lots of tests, but this is for one particular aspect of the technology. It's the pre-cooling system, which is used to cool the oxygen that's going in, that's taken in from the atmosphere. And so they need to prove that that's obviously functional. And so they're doing that by putting the pre-cooling module in front of a Viper jet engine, which is a 1960s vintage power unit, is how it's been described. And so, yeah.
Doesn't sound very safe, to be honest.
Well, they're not. It's not being put on a... It's undergoing tests. It's in fully testing environment.
Don't make them what I used to. Bust out the 1960s technology.
And assuming everything goes well with this, they're hoping to get like more investment and continue development, and in the future make sort of a smaller, full-sized engine that they could then test and show that the technology works sort of when it's put together. And, yeah, and then eventually space planes.
Amazing.
So my story this month concerns four white dwarf stars that are being studied by astrophysicists at the University of Warwick. And they were originally part of a Hubble Space Telescope survey designed to study the chemical composition of the atmosphere of white dwarfs. But there are two things which makes these four objects stand out in particular. And the first is that the dust in their atmosphere, which is believed to be the remnants of planets that once orbited them, is remarkably close to the composition of the Earth. So they see this as evidence that they were once orbited by Earth-like planets, which is very exciting to start off with. But the second thing is that the typical composition of the atmosphere of a white dwarf is mainly hydrogen helium. So what this means is that gravity would quickly pull any heavier elements into its core. So the fact that this Earth-like dust is seen at all means that we're seeing the planets in the very... very late stages of the life. So potentially the show what the Earth's future demise might look like.
It's brilliant, but it's terrifyingly brilliant.
But we won't be here to see it, so, you know.
Well, we will if we're watching it, like, now.
And I have a question about, are the white dwarves in, sort of, are they separated out? Are they four white dwarves that are...
Oh, the four individual objects are not, okay. Like, part of a system.
Okay.
Four separate objects where they've seen this. It was in quite a large survey. I think it was about 80 objects altogether. So
that's really awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool. They could use it, you know, all those apocalyptic films that come out about the end of the world. Instead of making up footage, they could just do a simulation and show actual footage of the end of the world. All right, and lastly, actually, I've got an update on the James Webb Telescope, which, as you'll know, is the successor to Hubble, and it's due to be launched in 2018. But just now, a very important instrument on it has actually been completed. It's built and it's ready to ship to the US, and it was a massive British contribution in completing this instrument, and it's called the Mid-Infrared Instrument, or MIRI. And it's about a £5 billion enterprise, and it's been built, and it's off to the US. And basically, what MIRI is going to do is it's going to look at starlight from the very first luminous objects in the universe. So it's going to be looking at stars from around 13 billion years ago. So back to the very, very beginning of the universe, and then we're talking the very first stars, which is phenomenal. And as with all these very complicated space-based instruments, it's freezing, so it's at minus 266 Kelvin. It's very cold, and but it has two very clever things on board in it as well. So it's an interferometer. It's going to be measuring starlight. They've also put in there a coronagraph, and the point of that is to block out very bright light signals so that MIRI will actually be able to block out a bright star, for instance, and just be able to look at the planet orbiting it. So not only can it look at sort of ancient stars, it could also look at ancient planets as well. And it's also got a spectrograph on it so that when they finish measuring the light from the stars, they can look at the different chemicals that may be in the stars themselves with a bit of spectroscopy. So, yeah, not only will it be capable of collecting data, it will be capable of doing a bit of data analysis up there as well. It's very impressive.
Awesome.
And from one excellent British contribution to astrophysics to another, here's Dr. Tim O'Brien answering your astronomical questions.
Our first question today is from Simon, who says, "Love the latest Jodcast. Can you answer this question for me? A free neutron evaporates, or so I'm told. So why doesn't a neutron star evaporate?"
Okay, so yeah, so I suppose we should first of all mention what a neutron star is. So a neutron star is something that's sort of left over as the remnant of a massive star that explodes at the end of its life. But the central part of the star collapses in on itself, and it makes effectively a dead star that's weighs as much as the sun, but about the size of a city, so about 20 kilometers across. So you've got a very dense object, and when you crush that thing down, as it collapses down on itself, you get a lot of electrons and protons that are basically form neutrons. So it's got a lot of neutrons in it, hence the term neutron star. You can imagine such a small object, if you took the whole sun and you squashed it down to be 20 kilometers across, the force of gravity is extreme. And just to give you a feel for that, maybe, if you were able to stand on the surface of a neutron star, the acceleration due to gravity that you'd feel is about 100 billion times more than the acceleration due to gravity we feel at the Earth's surface. So if you do a quick calculation, if you sort of held a bag of sugar out about a meter above the surface of a neutron star and let go of it, it would obviously accelerate down towards the surface. It would fall, and it would hit the surface a meter below, at a speed of 2000 kilometers per second. And it would then explode with the energy of 500 tons of TNT. So it's, so these are pretty extreme objects. And the reason they don't sort of collapse in on themselves any further, and make a black hole, is because of something called neutron degeneracy pressure, which is something that comes out of quantum physics. Basically means the neutrons can't be packed any closer than they already are. You get this sort of extra source of pressure that holds itself up against its own weight. Now, it's not entirely neutrons. And one reason we know that a neutron star isn't entirely neutrons is because they have very strong magnetic fields. And to get a magnetic field, you need charged particles. So there are electrons, there are protons, there are ions, even in the surface, we believe, of neutron stars. But they are dominated by neutrons. Now, the question related to something called neutron decay, or neutron evaporation, I think, was mentioned. If you take a neutron, which is normally inside the nucleus of an atom, and you pull it out into free space, and you sort of sit it there, it will decay with a half-life of about 10 minutes. It'll actually effectively turn into a proton, an electron, and an electron antineutrino. And that means if you had a population of them, you know, you had 1,000 of them, then 10 minutes later, 500 of them would have broken up into these into a proton, an electron, and this electron antineutrino. Now, that doesn't happen overall to a neutron star, because effectively we are in a position where these are free neutrons. They're packed into this extremely dense object. You do get neutron decay, so you will get neutron decays happening. It's actually this sort of, it's called a beta decay process. But you also get inverse beta decay, which means a proton can be converted back into a neutron. And you actually emit a positron and an electron neutrino. You can even capture an electron directly and emit an electron neutrino. So you basically end up with a sort of equilibrium where you're getting neutrons being converted to protons and protons being converted back to neutrons. And the net effect of that is that you produce these neutrinos and antineutrinos, and they can whiz out through the neutron star. And that's one way in which the neutron star can cool. It can lose energy by that process. So the whole star doesn't evaporate, but you do get neutron decays happening, but you also get the inverse process. So I hope that answers his question.
Next question is from John, who says, I have heard descriptions of the first few microseconds of the universe right after the Big Bang. I don't recall reading what are the key dimensions of the universe as it unfolds. For each point in time, what is the diameter of the universe, and what is its temperature?
Okay, right. So this is, in principle, could be a very long answer, but I'll try not to to do that. So the first thing to talk about is, you know, if we're talking about the size of the universe, we've got to be a little bit careful because, of course, the universe might be infinite. And so what we really have to think about is a sort of scale length in the universe. So it's a typical size scale. So if you like, you know, the distance between two points in the universe. And as the universe is expanding, that distance would increase. So we could think about what scale to pick. And just to answer this question, I think a good scale to pick might be the size of the observable universe. So this is the bit of the universe that we've had time to see since the Big Bang. In other words, the light's traveling towards us from a distant point in the universe. In the 14 billion years since the Big Bang, it's traveled a certain distance. We can see out to that point. So if you imagine this sort of sphere sitting around us, that's the bit of the universe we can see, but the universe itself might go on well beyond that. And in fact, we're we're sure that it really does go on for probably at least 20 or 25 times the scale of the observable universe. But let's think about that, the size of the observable universe. It turns out that the distance from here to the sort of edge of the observable universe, as best we can tell from observations of the cosmic microwave background, is about 14,000 megaparsecs. So 14 billion parsecs, which in old money is 46 billion light years. Okay, so that's the distance to the edge of the observable universe, which is sometimes a bit confusing because it's actually only nearly 14 billion years since the Big Bang, but actually the distance to the edge of the observable universe is bigger than that because the universe has been expanding since. So it's about roughly three times the age of the universe, so 46 billion light years. Now, if you sort of wind the clock back and you think about the universe shrinking, if you like, the distances between points reducing, then you can actually sort of do complicated cosmology. You can look at how the universe should expand with time, and there's lots of ways you can do that in detail. But if we just roughly think of a very simple case where the universe just expands at a constant rate, which actually is not a bad approximation, it turns out, because the age of the universe is about what we'd have got if the universe had been expanding at the same speed as it is now. That's what it turns out to be. So if we do that, we can actually answer a question like, we can say, okay, well, 1 second after the Big Bang, how big would the size of the observable universe be then compared to what it is now? So it would basically be 1 second as a fraction of the number of seconds in the 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang. So if you take that fraction, that gives you a number that's about 2 times 10 to the minus 18. So it's a very tiny fraction. Multiply that by the scale of the observable universe now, you end up with a number that's about a billion meters, another million kilometers, which is actually only about 3 times the distance to the moon. So if you can imagine the sort of scale of the observable universe at that time, 1 second after the Big Bang, it's only not much bigger than the scale of the Earth-Moon system, which is one way of thinking about it. There are obviously, you know, there's much more complications to that, if you like. We talk about inflation. There's a period in the universe, we think, our best ideas of cosmology at the moment allow for a period that a sort of special phenomenon called inflation, which happened just a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang, maybe only 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the Big Bang, when we think the universe suddenly rapidly increased in size, in scale size, by a factor of maybe somewhere between 10 to the 30 and 10 to the 60. So the universe got much, much bigger very rapidly. But then after that, it carried on expanding in this sort of, you know, roughly linear fashion that we just talked about. And there was a mention of temperature as well. And the simple thing about temperature is temperature just scales with size. So if we know how the size scale goes, then for example, when the cosmic microwave background was produced, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe was about 1,000 times smaller, or the scale sizes in the universe were 1,000 times smaller than they are now. And so the temperature is about 1,000 times bigger, so it's 1,000 times hotter. So we go from a temperature of the universe from the cosmic microwave background of about 3 Kelvin now, so that's minus 270 degrees Celsius, to a temperature of about 3,000 Kelvin, which is effectively, you know, the surface temperature of a big red giant star. So the universe was a sort of orangey red color, if you like, at the time that the cosmic microwave background was emitted. So I hope that's some help. Obviously not the great detail there, but it gives you some idea of how sizes and temperatures vary with age in the universe.
And then finally, we have a question from David, who starts by saying, "Hi, I thought up of this question while sitting in the dark between taking photos a few hundred feet underground in the slate mine. I'm aware that weakly interacting neutrinos can make it through a few hundred feet of rock, and these can be detected by equipment. I've also heard that cosmic rays have been detected by photographic sensors. My question is, if I am at a depth shallow enough for particles to reach me, would anything such as the particle itself or the decay products produce anything visible if they were to hit my retina? and how long would I have to wait?
Okay, we'll probably leave aside the question of why he was underground in a slate mine taking photos, but yeah, it's a good question. So first of all, let's just remember what neutrinos are. They're basically these sort of tiny subatomic particles, and they're produced in various ways, but they're certainly produced in the centre of the sun. So as a byproduct of the nuclear reactions that are taking place that power the sun. And there's many of these neutrinos produced that effectively whiz through the sun, hardly interacting with the body of the sun at all, and rush out into space in all directions. And actually, there's so many produced in the centre of the sun that as we're sitting here now, there's about 6 million of them passing through our brains every single second. So 6 × 10^12, 6 million neutrinos every second passing through our brains that have come from the centre of the sun. Now, you know, that sounds a little bit worrying, perhaps, but as was pointed out, they do actually interact very weakly with matter. So they basically rush straight through. The vast, vast majority of them just pass straight through with no interaction at all, so you wouldn't even notice them. So you would actually need a far, far bigger brain if you were going to use your brain to detect these particles. So the detectors that we do use are much bigger than that. How do we detect them? Well, they can interact. As you say, the chances of them interacting are pretty small, but they can interact. And when they do, they can actually accelerate. They can transfer some energy to a charged particle, for example, an electron. And that'll increase the speed of the electron. And in fact, you can, you know, make the electron then move at relativistic speed. So one of these high energy neutrinos can transfer enough energy to an electron to accelerate it to speeds that are a good fraction of the speed of light. Now, rather bizarrely, maybe, you can in fact accelerate these particles, these electrons, for example, to speeds that are faster than the speed of light. Now, don't worry, we're not going to get sort of caught up in whether neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light here, but it is actually possible to travel faster than the speed of light in a particular medium, in a particular type of material. And the reason is because light slows down as it passes through most materials. So in fact, what matters here is something called the refractive index of that material. So if you pick water, for example, then the speed of light in water is actually 3/4 of the speed of light in a vacuum. So you can actually get an electron, you can accelerate it to say 90% of the speed of light, and it will, and if it then travels through water, it will actually be traveling faster than light is possible to travel in that water. Now that effect, an analogy for that would be like a supersonic aircraft traveling faster than the speed of sound in the atmosphere. That produces a sonic boom, a shockwave traveling through the atmosphere. You effectively produce an optical shockwave when a charged particle travels faster than the speed of light in a medium like water. So that optical shockwave is called Cherenkov radiation. It's basically a flash of light. So some of these detectors, these neutrino detectors, and an example would be there's one called Super Kamiokande, which is in Japan. And basically it consists of a massive tank of water, 50,000 tons of water, pure water, surrounded by detectors that look for the tiny flashes of light that occasionally occur when a neutrino passes through that, large volume of water and produces one of these accelerations that causes one of these particles to travel faster than the speed of light and give you a Cherenkov flash. Now, even with that size of detector and the sophistication of that equipment, that actually for something like Super Kamiokande, they still only get several thousand detections a year in that volume of water. So if you think about that, if you go back to thinking about how many of these particles are rushing through our brains as we're speaking now, that volume, Super Kamiokande, is equivalent to about 50 million brains in terms of volume. So if you work those numbers out, you'd be waiting about 5,000 years for one of those interactions to take place in your brain. So you'd be waiting quite a long time for just one of those events. Now, we also mentioned cosmic rays in the question, and cosmic rays are actually charged particles themselves. So they're much more strongly interacting than neutrinos. They're arriving from outer space all the time. Some of them come from the sun, whether they be protons, electrons, the nuclei of atoms. Some of them are accelerated in supernova explosions or in active galaxies near the black hole at the centre of active galaxies. And if you're outside the atmosphere, the sort of flux of these cosmic rays is much higher because the atmosphere in some sense protects us from these things. And actually it is possible to see cosmic rays. And the astronauts, for example, if you go back to the Apollo missions, when they got well outside the atmosphere there, it turned out that the astronauts saw flashes of Cherenkov light, which are believed to be from cosmic rays, charged particles, whizzing through the sort of jelly of their eyeballs faster than the speed of light in their eyeball. And they were seeing something like a couple of flashes a minute sitting there in space. If they sort of let their eyes get used to the dark and closed their eyes, they were seeing these unusual flashes of light, which were these flashes of Cherenkov light. So yeah, so in that sense, you can use your eye as a detector for cosmic rays if you get above the atmosphere. But if you're trying to detect neutrinos, you need something that's a far, far larger volume than your eye. And even then, you still don't see very many detections.
And that's it for this month. Please send all of your questions via the webpage at www.jodcast.net.
Thanks for that, Tim and George. Now on to the feedback.
Well, first of all, we've had no post.
Boo!
Which is sad. Boo. So yeah, send us some post.
But please.
But we have had an email from John McKinney, who says he's now retired, but he did spend many hours listening on his vanpool rides into work at JPL in Pasadena, which is the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
It's unbelievably cool.
And now he finds himself working in his garden and still listens. So, yeah, thank you very much for listening and we hope you continue to.
And we've heard from Dan on the forum. He says, thanks for another great show. And we've also had some posts on Facebook. So thank you very much to everyone's contributions and keep telling us what you think and keep listening.
And once again, thanks for all the retweets and follow Fridays that we've had on Twitter. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can also send us post. The address is on the website. Now all that's left to say is thanks to Nick Germanic, Professor Alan Fitzsimmons and Dr. Thomas Target for the interviews, and Fotini Laiku for the JodBite. The editors were Melanie Gendre, Melis Irfan, Tim O'Brien, Christina Smith and Dan Thornton. The producer was Christina Smith. Until next time, Jod on!